Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Aaron Brown, sitting in today for Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Our topic today is How to Create New Jobs for Real, Part 2. And our guest is Dr. Walter Block, professor of economics at Loyola University, New Orleans. He's a senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute and author of Defending the Undefendable, among other titles. Welcome, Walter.
Thank you, Aaron. I'm delighted to be here with you, Aaron and Zoe.
Yeah, glad to be back. And we also have with us today special commentator Zoe Russell. Zoe is a graduate of Auburn University in business economics. She attended Mises University 2009 and continues her study of free market economics in Houston, Texas. So welcome, Zoe.
Hi, good to be here.
Okay, so today's show is the second part of an interview we did with Dr. Block based on an article he wrote called A Primer on Jobs and the Jobless. And our objective here today is to clarify the jobs question and show our audience how to create jobs for real. I think to begin this conversation, we must first ask, what are new jobs good for, Walter? What purpose do they serve? Are jobs desirable in and of themselves?
No, jobs are a bad thing. They're a pain in the neck. Otherwise, there wouldn't be jobs. But we have to have them because we have scarcity. Scarcity means we want more stuff than we have. And the only way to get it is to work harder or want less. And Gandhi, the ascetic from India, worked on scarcity in the other direction, namely he wanted less and less, although he wanted the British out of India, which is no small thing. But apart from that, he wanted very little, just his diaper and his maybe shoes and maybe some goat's milk or something like that. So his wants were very, very small. But most people aren't like that, and even he wanted that stuff. Whereas most of us, you know, if we had a wish list, you know, what would we like? The sun, the moon, the stars, a cure for cancer, space travel, infinite life, whatever. Lots of things we want. And since we don't live in the Garden of Eden where stuff comes down onto us like manna, and then we sort of convert the manna into a Maserati or into a yacht or something, we don't have that. So the only way we can get stuff that we want is to work for it, unfortunately. But that's the situation that we're in.
So you talk about in your article the Swiss Family Robinson, and we know they're marooned on a desert island. You take us out of a complex economy and show us an economy on the individual level. Can you tell us their story and how it shows that we don't just work for no reason?
Yes, I think the Swiss Family Robinson is a good example. They're marooned on some desert island, and they've got a lot of wants and not that much stuff. They've got a wrecked ship and then maybe a hammer and a saw and a few other things, but they need a house to protect them from wild animals. They need to catch some fish. They need to maybe start building a rowboat so they can get out of there eventually. They have a lot of things that they have to do. Now, suppose the 10-year-old is told, okay, go fish, and he gets one fish a day. But he's a bright young lad, and what he does is he builds a net, and now he can make five fish a day, and the family doesn't need that many fish. So he's now unemployed. Well, is this a bad thing? No, it's not a bad thing, because he's unemployed due to the fact of his own brilliance. And now the family can assign him to some other job. And now they can have all the fish they want, or they can have five fish a day instead of one fish a day. Plus, they can have other things, or they can have one fish a day, and since it only takes them, a half hour, an hour to get that one fish, three-quarters or four-fifths of his day is now free to do something else. So what I was trying to do here is to get at Ludditism, the idea that machinery will take our jobs away. And the point that Henry Hazlitt makes, a very famous Austrian economist, it's not that we want jobs, it's that we want the things that jobs give us. And in the case of the Swiss Family Robinson, we want the fish that this job gave us. And if we can get the fish without the work, because this kid is so brilliant, he makes a net or whatever, well, then that's great.
Let me interrupt you there, Walter. Yeah. We've got to head to a break, but we'll be right back with Radio Free Market.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to Radio Free Market. We're here back with Dr. Walter Block. We were just discussing the Swiss Family Robinson. The boy can catch more fish with his net. With his limited resources, including time, he can do much more. Can you elaborate on the idea?
Yeah, what I'm trying to illustrate is Ned Ludd. What happened, this guy was, I forget what century, maybe the 18th century, and before that, the way they knitted shirts and woolens and stuff was the old-fashioned way of knitting that you see old ladies, well, young ladies too, knit. And then they came up with a loom, and the loom could create, one person could create as many sweaters or as many clothing goods as 20 people before the old-fashioned way. And Ned Ludd said, whoa, we can't have that, because if one person creates 20 sweaters where one person, where it used to take 20 people to create 20 sweaters, well, 19 people will be unemployed. So what he did, him and his buddies, they went around burning knitting looms on the ground that he was saving jobs. He didn't realize that we don't need jobs. What we need is the clothing that the jobs make possible. A modern-day Luddite is Ted Kaczynski, who was the Unabomber. He would go and actually bomb factories because factories were producing a lot of stuff. Right now at Loyola University New Orleans, they're putting in some building. They're uncovering some pipes. They're digging holes. And the way they're doing it is with steam shovels. And it takes one or two or three people, and they can make a big hole in the ground in a couple of days. Whereas if you had people with picks and shovels, it would take, hundreds of people a month. And if they were doing it with teaspoons, it would take thousands of people a year. So we could create jobs endlessly, but the point is not to create jobs. The point is to create the stuff. If we wanted to create millions of jobs, what we could do is get rid of all trains and 18-wheeler trucks and have people ship stuff on their back in the form of 50-pound sacks from New Orleans to where are you guys living?
Houston.
Houston, from New Orleans to Houston or to California, California even better yet because it's further away. We could create billions of jobs, but the point is that if we did that, then we wouldn't have all the other things that people could do. So I keep reiterating the brilliant Hazlitt point that we want is productivity. We don't want jobs. Jobs are a necessary evil. They're an evil because, you know, they're a pain in the neck. We don't want to do them. We'd rather play, but we have to work sometimes in order to create goods and transmit them hither and thither.
Mm-hmm. And in preparation for the show, we wanted to lead off with that point because that is the crux of the argument, that jobs are not good in and of themselves. If we could create machines that, as Dr. Block says, would bring down goods like manna from heaven, even though there were less jobs, that would still be a wonderful thing because we would have the goods that we require to be happy and go out and play and have a high quality of life. So it is the things that jobs create that is the good. The jobs are not the good part. As Dr. Block said, jobs are unpleasant. No one likes jobs. So we want the goods and services that jobs create.
And with regard to play, you know, sometimes you think of playing and you think, well, you play basketball, you play chess. Well, some people could play at creating symphonies or creating new plays or inventing new things to get us to Mars in a better way or whatever.
Or being economics professors.
Or, yes, being economics professors. Thank you.
Okay, so the first, one of the topics, really the one that I really wanted to touch on in the first show, but we ran out of time, is licensing laws. And I wanted to talk about licensing laws and how they affect employment or unemployment. And this is a hugely important topic and one that should be studied extensively by every listener. We're going to discuss how licensing laws increase unemployment and they drive up the cost of everything. So I'm just going to throw out a few stats to begin this segment on licensing laws. There were a study that Michael McKay showed me in preparation for this show. Dentists were able to charge 11% more in states with the most restrictive licensing laws. In the 1950s, 5% of workers needed a license. Now 20% are in an occupation that need a license to work. And approximately 30%, one out of every three workers nationwide, needs a government license to do their job. So, Walter, most people take licenses for granted as a good thing because if you know, what would the world be like if there were hair cutters and manicurists who didn't have licenses, wouldn't there just be a bunch of hoodlums and swindlers out there?
Well, that's the argument in favor of it, but what you're really doing is you're harking back to the Middle Ages where you had the guild system where you just couldn't start being a plumber or a carpenter or a candlestick maker or a baker or whatever. You had to get permission of the guild, and the guild didn't want to give you permission because they wanted to keep fewer people in there, and the fewer the people and the fewer the candles and the bakery goods, the higher the price. So this is a medieval kind of a system. Now, yes, we do want quality. We don't want, you know, you don't want to go to a doctor, say, to take the most favorable case for licenses. You don't want to go to a doctor and, who's that doctor on The Simpsons, that crazy guy where he
Dr. Nick.
Dr. Nick, that's right. You don't want a Dr. Nick where you go to Dr. Nick and he sort of takes a buzzsaw and he cuts off your arm because your nose hurts or something like that. I'm exaggerating, but that's roughly Dr. Nick. Equality. And Milton Friedman is very good on this one in his book, Capitalism Freedom. I'm not usually a fan of Milton Friedman because I think he's too weak on free enterprise, but on occupational licensure, he is sound as a bell. He is magnificent. And what he says is, look, if you have a monopoly licensing agency like the AMA or these hospitals, what they're going to do is restrict entry. They're not going to restrict entry in order to improve quality. They're going to restrict entry in order to keep people out so that their salaries can go up. And he has all sorts of evidence that that's what's going on. For example, foreign doctors. They make foreign doctors take exams in English. Well, why in English? Which precludes a lot of doctors who have some English, but English is a second language. I mean, aren't there unconscious patients? And couldn't a non-English speaking doctor take care of unconscious patients? And what about, say, somebody from, Portugal? Couldn't he take care of fellow Portuguese or other people who speak Portuguese, like from Brazil? And that's why God invented translators. You know, it might cost more to get a nurse who could translate, but that should be no one's business. So what Milton Friedman says is that what the AMA is doing is precluding entry. They're keeping people out so that, doctors can make more money, and they've succeeded to a great degree. Doctors make a lot more money than they would in the free enterprise system, where entry were free in the sense that no one was licensed, but you'd have to be certified. So what's the difference between certification and licensing? Well, in licensing, if you don't have the license, you can't practice. In certification, like the CPA, Certified Public Accountant, you have to pass a test by, I don't know, the Harvard Medical School or someone like that, or the Acme Insurance Agency. And if you don't pass the test, well, you can still practice. You can be a Dr. Nick, but you can't hang up a shingle saying certified by the Harvard Medical School.
Mm-hmm.
And most people would, you know, look before they leap. Before they go to Dr. Nick, they'd say, well, who certified you? And Dr. Nick would say, well, my mother did, or Homer Simpson did, or something like that, and people just wouldn't go to him. So the point that Milton Friedman makes is that you get higher quality from a competitive certification industry. Like, suppose somebody certifies Dr. Nick, and Dr. Nick kills someone. Well, that certification agency is going to go broke. Whereas suppose the AMA certifies a doctor who is very bad. Well, they never go broke because they're the monopoly agency. Let me just go on with one more example. This is, you know, black people nowadays get their hair braided, very finely braided, and there are young black girls who are very good at this braiding, and they've been put in jail because they didn't go to, hair cutting school or...
Cosmetology.
Cosmetology school,
yeah.
Whatever it is. Thank you. And, you know, in order to do that, you have to take thousands of hours to study biology and all sorts of crap, and these girls don't need it, and their customers are very happy, and none of them have been hurt. It's a non-issue. And yet, these poor young ladies who could have good careers in hair braiding for black and white people, I suppose some white people get that, but they're not allowed to do it. And this is just a horrendous sort of a thing. The Institute for Justice, which is a very good group, has launched several lawsuits in behalf of these young ladies to try to get the government off their back.
Mm-hmm. And on that point, it's even though the licensing laws, for example, for these young black ladies, or for as a study by Morris Kleiner from the University of Minnesota showed, These stricter laws don't even noticeably affect the quality of the service. For example, this study showed that stricter licensing laws didn't noticeably affect dental health, and I would take a gander that the putting these girls in jails didn't raise the quality of hair braiding.
Absolutely not, because the purpose of it is not to raise the quality. The purpose is to keep the monopoly privileges for the mainstream hair braiders or the mainstream cosmetologists or whoever they are. So that's the exact purpose of it. Another example I sometimes use is the case of thalidomide, which was a very good morning sickness drug, but it created in some small percentage babies with malfunctions, you know, like three arms or one arm or something like that. And this was supported by the Food and Drug Administration. It was a complicated thing. The West German Food and Drug Administration supported it. The U.S. one allowed it and didn't prohibit it. See, the problem there is we not only want to have good doctors and good hair braiders, we want to have good medicine and good pharmaceuticals. So what's the best way to do it? Is the best way to do it to give it the whole thing to the Food and Drug Administration and let them decide? Or is it better to have an industry that certifies quality of drugs?
Mm-hmm.
And you're free to have the drug if it's not certified, or certainly if it's not certified by the FDA. You see, if any private certification agency certified thalidomide, they would be broke or gone the next day. Nobody would patronize them. But the FDA is still in business. So that's like a type 1 error, accepting a bad drug. So now what the FDA does is engages in type 2 errors, namely it prohibits possibly good drugs. And now in order to get a new drug on the market...
Okay, Walter, I'm sorry to interrupt you. We're coming close to the end of this segment. We will be back with our next segment talking with Walter Block on how to create new jobs. Please stay with us. Hello, America. We are back on Radio Free Market with Dr. Walter Block talking about how to create new jobs. And Dr. Block, you were talking about the FDA and thalidomide babies, so please continue that thought.
Right. The point is that they're now creating type 2 errors where they're putting all sorts of roadblocks in the face of introducing new medicine. It takes 10 years and you know, many millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, and meanwhile people are dying for lack of drugs. In the free enterprise system, we would have a competitive industry, and you could do whatever you wanted. If you were an adult, you could take a drug, even though none of the agencies approved of it. It's at your own risk. There are these cases where people have been given, you know, 2 months to live, they're dying of cancer, and they want to try something. They want to try experimental drugs because, you know, that's the only shot they've got, and the bloody FDA won't allow them to do it because not only does it have to be proven not harmful, but it has to be proven beneficial. And these poor people, they're at death's door, and they want to try something. They want to throw the dice, and the bloody FDA won't allow them to. I think they ought to be put in jail for murder for preventing people from trying things.
Yeah, I completely agree. It is a travesty. I know that I have a family member who just recently had cancer, and you have to go to a different country to try these treatments that the FDA does not approve of, but nevertheless, they show amazing promise to be, you know, not as sort of harmful as chemotherapy, and it is very sad that that happens. And to that point, I want to ask you about the American Medical Association. We talked about that in the last segment. You know, one of the things that we hear today is the cost of healthcare is rising. Why? You know, the cost of healthcare is you know, the government really wants to try and solve this problem. But then you look at the AMA, forces all medical schools to reject 95% of all applicants. So simple supply and demand would tell us that we're going to have a shortage of doctors. Do you think this regulation that creates a shortage of doctors probably benefits existing doctors, does it not?
Yes, it benefits existing doctors, and it pumps up their prices, which makes it difficult if you're not insured. Medical insurance is why we have that whole crisis. Namely, here the government creates the problem in the first place by not allowing medical schools to accept more applicants and by not allowing new medical schools to open. And then after creating the problem, it tries to cure it with socialized medicine, which just exacerbates the problem. Mises talked about this, where the government creates problem A and then it tries to solve it, which creates problem B, and each problem gets worse, C, D, and E, and you're off to the races.
I think that sort of segues into my question. It's always, you look back at history and then the government will take the success of capitalism as their own. So can you tell us about child labor? I know that the common belief is that if the government didn't step in and have child labor laws, we'd have sweatshops and 8-year-olds working in coal mines.
Right. Well, this is another fallacy. Look, suppose we had implemented child labor laws in 1650, right before the Industrial Revolution, and said that no children under 16 can work. What would have happened? Well, a lot of 16 and under children would have died, because we were so poor in those days, centuries ago, that if the children didn't work and create enough for them to eat, they would die. So this couldn't have worked then, compulsory school until 16 or something like that in the year 1650 is just ludicrous. But what happened is, thank God we had the Industrial Revolution, and then we had more of a spurt due to free enterprise in the 19th century. And each time we got richer, what the government did is it started in implementing child labor laws, and it started increasing the age at which children couldn't work, thus taking credit for what the free enterprise system was doing. In other words, the reason that the fewer and fewer children had to work was we were getting richer and richer. And the reason we were getting richer and richer is because we had free enterprise and capitalism. And then the government takes credit for it by saying, see, we raised the child labor laws, we implemented them. And it's the same not only with child labor, but with hours legislation. You know, it used to be in the bad old days, people had to work 100, 120 hours a week just to survive. And as we got richer, we could afford to work less. And then the government kept reducing the maximum hours that we could work. So they would, let's say the capitalist system was successful and now people, instead of working 100 hours, had to work 90. So the government would now have a new law saying, well, you can't work more than 90. And then 20 years later, we could go down to 80 hours a week thanks to free enterprise and breakthroughs. And then the government would take credit for this by implementing another law. The point is that if the government implemented the law too quickly, there'd be mass starvation.
Mm-hmm.
And true or false, a child can be fined or shut down for operating a lemonade stand without a license?
Yes, true. Unfortunately, there have been cases where some little tyke of age, I don't know, 8 years old, sets up a lemonade stand in front of his house, and the government comes along and says, you know, where's your business license? Are you exploiting your employees, like his mother and father who are getting the lemonade for him? I mean, it's just ludicrous what the government will do under the guise of helping us, and it's just sort of busybody socialism.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm kind of interested about, you know, we'll have to address this in the next segment because we're coming close to the end. But in our next segment, I wanted to hear your comment on, you know, what kind of psychologically this does to the young population of, you know, 9 or 10-year-olds who wants to try and make some money, you know, selling lemonade on the corner during the summer. You know, what does this do to kind of the working-age population who wants to make a living and make some money, but they're unable to because of the government? So we're going to have to talk about this in the next segment. Please stay with us on Radio Free Market. We're here with Dr. Walter Block. Hello, America. We're back on Radio Free Market with Dr. Walter Block. And I wanted to lead in the segment with this question that we addressed at the end of the last segment. What is the kind of the psychological effect on young workers who are maybe want to make some summer money, for example, selling lemonade, and they're unable to because of licensing laws?
Well, obviously, it can't be very good. We're trying to socialize young people, children, into lives of productive work, and if we tell them at the get-go, right at the outset, that no, you can't do a lemonade stand, they'll go back to watching TV or something else. I don't know, maybe take piano lessons, which isn't so bad. But all facilities of children should be developed, not just piano lessons and swimming or whatever in the summer. But if they want to be, entrepreneurial and they want to sell lemonade or they want to deliver newspapers or whatever, We have all sorts of child labor laws. You can't do this, you can't do that, you can't set up a lemonade stand. There are actually cases on record where parents got arrested for allowing their children to sell lemonade. And what's the poor little kitty to make of it? I mean, little Susie gets the jackboot, maybe not literally, although maybe sometimes, and she's told that, you know, you can't do this, this is illicit, and she says, well, you know, well, maybe there's something wrong with commerce. And that's what they teach in a lot of business schools, too. I happen to be in a business school, and you go to medical school, at least if you're admitted, they say medicine is good, and you go to law school, and they say law is great. You go to business schools, and sometimes they're apologetic about business. You know, you want to make a profit, but not too much. So I guess it starts with young children. Young children are, in effect, told you can't work. And then also the minimum wage law, with lemonade stands, they're told they can't set up their own businesses. Minimum wage law makes it impossible for them to work for someone else. So you have hordes of kids who are a little bit bored because there's only so much swimming you can do and so much bicycle riding in the summer, and they want to work and make some money and maybe buy presents or buy a computer or whatever, and the minimum wage law prevents that as well.
Mm-hmm. And I could speak directly to that about business schools. Not really demonizing people who make too much money, but certainly there's a bias towards praising CEOs, for example, who will take a pay cut or who will take a lower salary, which is honorable, absolutely, but you can definitely see the bias at a modern business school. So I have a family friend, and I won't name him, but and his view is, he's a Paul Krugman fanatic, by the way. He says, if it weren't for the government, we'd all be eating radioactive waste, breathing asbestos, and drinking paint in our milk. How would you respond to this view? Because I was so stunned by that, I couldn't even respond. I was speechless.
Well, I think it's to the extent that we still have these problems, it's because of the government. It's not because of free enterprise. Because, again, what you want when you have a certification activity, the certification function, what you want is a system where if you're a good certifier, you can prosper and expand your base of operation, and if you're a bad certifier, you lose customers, people don't patronize you, people don't trust you, and eventually you have to go broke. And that's why we have reasonably good rubber bands and paper clips and pens and shoes and ties and shoelaces and pizza, because if you don't produce these things well, you lose money, and if you don't produce them well for a long enough time, you go broke, and the ones who remain are the ones who are doing a pretty good job. So we don't have a banana crisis or a burger crisis or anything like that because of the profit and loss system of free enterprise. But this works as well for certification. If you do a good job as a certifier, like I don't know, kosher foods or good housekeeping seals of approval or things like that, well, then people trust you. And if you do a bad job, you go broke and you're out of it. Whereas when you have the government, you're putting all your eggs in one basket. And if they do a good job, they don't get more money. And if they do a bad job, they don't get less money. If they do a bad job, probably they get more money because they need more money. I don't know. I mean, take the post office. When the post office does a better off with a privatized post office industry where they can compete with each other or with one monopoly post office. Well, this insight that applies to postal delivery and to raisins and shoelaces also applies to certification. What we want is an industry where if you do a bad job, you go broke. I'm in New Orleans. We had Katrina, and because of FEMA and the Army Corps of Engineers, 1,800 people were killed in New Orleans. Are FEMA still in business? Yes. Is
Absolutely.
The Army Corps of Engineers still in business? Yes. Suppose 1,800 people died in Disney World. Would Disney World be in business anymore? Of course not.
Absolutely. So our listeners, I hope you're starting to see that these government laws that, you know, whether they are well-intentioned or not, they hurt usually the poorest of the poor, the people who are least capable. So I want to relate that to taxes. How do tax increases affect business people, and especially the smaller ones?
Well, you know, right now, the reason business isn't hiring is because of something that Robert Higgs calls regime uncertainty. Namely, they're sort of like deer caught in headlights. They're frozen. They don't know what to do. Obama keeps changing the rules, keeps changing everything, and people are afraid to hire. So you get that sort of a phenomenon. When taxes go up or they keep changing, business are less able than otherwise to hire people, to allow jobs to be created. When the government taxes more, more money gets circulated through the so-called public sector, namely the socialist sector, and less through the private sector. Our unemployment rate isn't as bad as it would be, except for the fact that the government is hiring a lot of people to work for the government. And the way they can do that is to raise taxes so they can pay the salaries of the workers. I don't know. I go around the streets of New Orleans, and I see these people that are cleaning the streets or fixing the streets, and there are 50 of them, and 49 of them are standing around looking, just holding their shovels, and one of them is digging. If you had private enterprise, that kind of a company would go broke. So the point is, we can create all the jobs we want, and they created a lot of jobs in Russia under the Soviet system, where everything was funneled through the government sector. You could have a lot of jobs, but then you had hidden unemployment, where the workers were, you know, some workers were creating hammers, but nobody was creating nails, and vice versa, and the Soviet system went belly up. So the more taxes we have, the more government enterprise we have, and the less private enterprise, the more toward the Soviet system of communism we go, the worse we're going to be.
What if we didn't have taxes? How would the world survive? Like, aren't there just some things that are so big that only the government can do, like building freeways or ports or the Panama Canal?
Well, one of my recent books is on why we should privatize highways, so it's apropos here. I don't think there's anything that private enterprise can't do. Let me just say this before I get into that. There are two types of libertarians. One is anarchist libertarians or anarcho-capitalists, and the other is minimal government libertarians or minarchists. And the anarchists say that everything can be done by private enterprise and the government need not do anything. Whereas the minarchists say, well, there are certain things that the government, only the government can do. And the main thing, the main role that they assign to the government is to protection of persons and property rights. And to that end, you need three institutions, according to the Randians, who would be minarchists, an example. One, you need armies to keep foreign bad guys off of us. Not, Ron Paul would say, to go out and have 100 or 1,000 military bases in 200 different countries. Second, police to keep local bad guys off of us, not to uphold drug laws and victimless crime laws, which put people in jail unnecessarily, but to stop murders and rapes and theft, and three courts to decide who the good guys and the bad guys are. But whether you're a minarchist libertarian or an anarchist libertarian, no one would say in that field or in that philosophy would say, well, there are certain things that are too big that only government can do, because that's why God invented the stock market. If there's something really big that I want to go to the moon or I want to go to Mars, and if people think that this is going to be a paying proposition and that would be a real big expenditure, what I do is I float a bond issue or a stock issue on Wall Street, and I say, hey, I got a company. We're going to go to the moon and get green cheese and we're going to sell it or something like that, and I'll give you a share if you give me $100, and I'll sell 10 million shares and I'll have $1 billion, and I'll go off and I'll start doing it. So, I mean, where does government get the money from in the first place to make a Panama Canal or to make roads or to make bridges or to make moonshots or whatever? It gets it through taxes. Mm-hmm. Namely, millions of people pay it. Well, millions of people could pay it if they thought it was a good idea through the
right.
stock market.
So the government's just big enough to waste that large enough of money.
Oh, the government and waste is, waste is government's middle name. And again, the reason for that is that they don't have this market weeding out system which rewards profitable non-waste and penalizes waste.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I really recommend that everyone pick up a copy of Defending the Undefendable, because it has so many topics that you would just never think should be legal or could be legal or could work, but they do in just this voluntary framework that libertarians talk about. So last interview, we were only able really briefly to touch upon one of my favorite topics, which is the Fed, the Federal Reserve, and the money creation. I'm sure many of our listeners have heard somewhere or the other that the government prints money, quote, out of thin air. So first, Walter, does the Federal Reserve actually print money out of thin air?
Well, they do a little bit nowadays. Most of it is now just banking deposits, entries into banking statements. But yes, the government creates money, whether it's cash, which would be printing it, or through the banking system. Yes, the government creates money through thin air. They can create as much money as they want. Our man Bernanke, Benny the paper hanger Bernanke, is having quantitative easing 1 and quantitative easing 2, and who knows, quantitative easing 3. These are just words for creating more money. Now, this is a horrible thing in two ways. One, when the government creates more money, we have inflation. And one of the reasons that we had World War II and the rise of Hitler is because we had the German hyperinflation of 1923, which just undermined the German society, and Hitler came in as partially as a result of that. Zimbabwe now, you can be a zillionaire, you know, a loaf of bread costs $3 trillion. We're happily not in at that point. We don't have hyperinflation. We don't even have inflation now. Much of it, but he's been creating a lot of money, Bernanke, and the banks haven't been lending it out, but when and soon I expect the banks to start lending it out, and when they do, with the multiplier, with the fractional reserve system that we have, if the fractional reserve is 10%, which it roughly is, they'll create 10 times as much money as the money that the Fed creates. And this brings me to another point about unemployment, which is the main subject of the hour. What the Fed does when it creates money, it does two things. One, it increases prices, and that's inflation. But it does something, and sort of a lot of people know about this, although not everyone knows about it. Some people blame corporate greed for inflation. But most, at least economists or sophisticated people in economics know that the government creates money, and that feeds inflation. We have the quantity theory of money. But there's a much more insidious thing that also happens when the Fed creates money, and that is that it lowers interest rates artificially lower than they otherwise would have been. And what this does is it leads to production or investment in areas that never would have been invested in if the interest rate hadn't been artificially lowered. I don't know how much time we've got more in this segment. It's sort of a complicated issue, so I'll start now on this, and if I don't have time, maybe I can continue in the next segment.
We have about 4 minutes, so what Dr. Block is about to explain is the Austrian theory of the business cycle.
Absolutely.
And also we have a couple of shows upcoming where we're going to talk about Keynesian versus Austrian ideas of why this happens. So what you're about to hear is very important, and it's called the Austrian theory of the business cycle. So go ahead, Dr. Block. You have about 3 minutes.
it's a tough row to hoe, but I'll make a start.
We have faith in you.
Let me approach this circuitously. I'm a professor. I'm never supposed to say anything directly. Right now, the allocation of resources between rubber bands and raisins is okay. In other words, there's no crisis. No one is saying we have way too many raisins and way too few rubber bands. But suppose the government started subsidizing raisins and started taxing rubber bands such that we had many, many more raisins than we would otherwise want and many fewer rubber bands than we would otherwise want. And they kept doing it and doing it and doing it. And then what happened is that a lot of people left their jobs in rubber bands and started employment in raisins. And then all of a sudden they had to stop. And now we would see that there are investments in raisins that were silly to have made. We're up to our armpits in raisins. We don't need all those raisins. And there's vast unemployment in the raisin industry, and there's vast underemployment in the rubber band industry. Well, what we need now is to not prop up the raisin industry anymore. It's been propped up too much. Rather, we need to get people out of raisins and into rubber bands, and that's going to take a while because, you know, people just don't go instantaneously from a job that they shouldn't be in to a job they should be in. Okay. Well, now let's get, with that introduction, let's get into Austrian business cycle theory. What the lowering of the interest rate does, it does not subsidize raisins, but it subsidizes something else. Namely, it subsidizes heavy industry. The Austrians believe in this thing called the structure of production. Capital is not a homogeneous good. There are various kinds of capital. There's some capital that's heavy industry, and they create stuff that is years and years away from consumption, like mining or heavy manufacturing or houses or cars or things like that. It takes a long time to make those things. On the other hand, what a lower interest rate does is it takes investments away from industries that are shorter run, that are closer to consumption, say retailing and wholesaling. So what we have is way too many people in cars and houses and mines and factories and way too few people in retailing. And that's what the reason for that is the according to the Austrian business cycle theory of Hayek and Mises and Rothbard, the reason for that is that the government artificially lowered the interest rate, and this served as a subsidy or an inducement or an incitement on the part of entrepreneurs to invest in roundabout methods of production, Bomberwerk, another Austrian would say, and not enough investments in these other areas. So I think the analogy between raisins and rubber bands is an apt one, and the reason I mention raisins and rubber bands is that it's easier for people to wrap their minds around it, whereas it's harder for them to see long-run goods and short-run goods. But the reason we have a housing bubble is because houses are a long-term investment. Am I running out of time?
We have about 20 seconds left. Yeah, I'm going to take it from here. We're coming near the end of the segment, folks. So we're going to be back here with Dr. Walter Block talking about job creation. We'll come back. We will talk a little more about the Federal Reserve and the business cycle. So stay with us. We'll be back on RadioFreeMarket.com.
Welcome back to Radio Free Market. We're here with Dr. Walter Block. Dr. Block was just telling us about the business cycle theory, the Austrian business cycle theory, and why so many people built and bought houses in this last housing bubble. Dr. Block?
Yes. I think I would like to mention several books that people could follow up on. Perhaps the best introduction to this is a thing by Murray Rothbard, which is called Depressions, Their Cause and Cure. All of this stuff is available for free, I think, on the Mises web. Certainly that one is. There's a book by Robert Murphy, who is an excellent critic of Krugman on business cycle theory, and he's got a book on the Great Depression. Another one is Murray Rothbard's book called The Great Depression. And then there's one by Tom Woods, a book called Meltdown. I think it's a longer title. It's got a subtitle. But Meltdown is the key element there. So if people would get a hold of those four books, they would have a very good introduction into this. I've only barely scratched the surface of it. Another contributor to this is Roger Garrison. And then, of course, there's Hayek. But now we're getting into more technical stuff that maybe people who are studying this seriously would get involved in.
Okay, so, you know, the answer to all of these issues that, all these things that we've talked about that cause and employment, licensing and taxes, the answer to all these seems to be the free market, in your opinion. Does the free market mean utopia? Is that what we're trying to tell people?
Well, I agree. Free enterprise is the cure for what ails you, but free enterprise will not bring about a utopia. The only thing that will do that is manna and heaven and the Garden of Eden and stuff like that, which is very unrealistic. No, the free enterprise system will just enable human beings, imperfect human beings, to do the best they can given their limitations of intelligence, of initiative, of entrepreneurial ability. The free enterprise system will just enable human beings to do the best they can. Whereas when you substitute the government for the free enterprise system, then human capacities decrease and we create poverty. So the free enterprise system is not a utopia. If we had free enterprise, we're not going to cure all disease and there'd still be some poverty, but less disease and less poverty and more wealth and more human cooperation.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, we talk about the business cycles. In a free market, there there will most likely be business fluctuations and periods of relatively higher unemployment. But, in our opinion, the free market at least minimizes the scope of damage that would be done to the economy during a business cycle type event. Could you comment on that?
Well, Murray Rothbard, in his book, Depression is Cause and Cure, which is a mini book, a very small book, goes into this and says, look, if it if hula hoops come into effect or hula hoops are suddenly popular, there'll be unemployment because people are going to have to be drawn away from other tasks and put into hula hoop factories, and there'll be transitional unemployment as you get them from one place to another. And then when the hula hoop phase goes out, and entrepreneurs are left with unsold hula hoops, well, now all the people in the hula hoop factories are going to have to go do other things, things that people now want, like, I don't know what, umbrellas, paper clips, who knows. So people keep changing their minds, styles change. Do you know how the automobile industry devastated the horse and buggy industry? I mean, it just created vast unemployment among whip makers and horse breakers and people like that, and the computer industry created vast unemployment in the typewriter industry. I don't know, you people are probably too young to know what a typewriter is, but a typewriter is sort of like a computer without a computer. It's got a keyboard, and you type directly onto paper. Well, this sort of unemployment is not generalized unemployment, Murray Rothbard would say. It's just the fact that inventions occur or tastes change, and you'll get some unemployment, transitional unemployment, as people are led by Adam Smith's invisible hand out of typewriters and into computers or out of horses.
Walter, I hate to interrupt because that's such a great point, but that is the end of our show today. So just want to leave our listeners and thank you to Walter Block for being with us today. This is Aaron Brown and Zoe Russell with Radio Free Market. Please visit us on the web at radiofreemarket.com, where you can subscribe for free to all of our shows and our archives for easy downloads. Until next week, wherever you are, please stand up for freedom. Thank you for listening.